This is ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
That's right. Can you dig it?
It's time for 2 hours of the best sports talk on the airwaves.
Can you dig it?
The Jordy Holtberg Show with your host, the Blonde Bomber himself.
Can you dig it?
Jordy Holtberg.
Good afternoon and hello there. Hope everybody's doing great on this day when Reggie Bush is back. The Pelicans try to even their best of seven series. The Saints wondering how many offensive linemen are going to be off the board before they pick at number 14. And so much more. All these stories. Congrats to the Cajun softball team for taking it to LSU last night. So all these stories and much, much more coming your way today, Wednesday, April 24th, the year 2024, another Chamber of Commerce Day. My main man, James Mesh, back in the Master Control Suite of the EVCO Development Studios, which are on the campus of Delta Media, where you'll find ESPN 103.7 Lafayette under its umbrella. Move west, you'll find ESPN 104.1 in Lake Charles. Thrilled to be there. We're streaming everywhere. In case you can't hear us on the radio, we're all over the world thanks to our free mobile app, ESPN SouthwestLouisiana.com. Our guests come to us via the Mike's Marine Hotline at 337-706-0111. Mike's Marine, keeping you on the water. Good day for Reggie Bush. He's getting his 2005 Heisman Trophy back. A formal reinstatement is expected to come today. No brainer. One of the greatest college football players ever. Good news, great news, deserved news for him. In the NBA, the Mavericks beat the Clippers last night, 96-93, to take a 2-0 lead. They tied the series at one apiece. The Timberwolves beat the Suns 105-93 to take a 2-0 lead, and the Pacers beat the Bucks 125-108 to even their best of seven series. Tonight, two more ball games. Boston hosting the Miami Heat with the Celtics leading that series 1-0, and the Thunder hosting the Pelicans game two. OKC leads that one 1-0. Christian Clark will join us from Oklahoma City, the home of Sonic, and preview tonight's ball game. Very, very important ball game there. LSU baseball won last night. They took it to Nichols. They had an outstanding job by their pitching staff. My goodness gracious. They went the distance. Dominant 9-0 win. Five LSU throwers combined to shut out the Colonels, limited them to just 3 hits. Defensively, LSU played error-free ball, and they got a bunch of home runs in the game. And all said and done, the Tigers had double-digit hits, a season-high 5 home runs to get the win. And now that midweek game is a confidence boosting tune-up, you would think, for LSU as they prepare to welcome Auburn to the box for a 3-game series this weekend. If LSU's to reach 14 wins this season, a mark that would safely secure them a spot in the NCAA tournament, the Tigers at 5-13 need to get at least one sweep in their final 4 series, and everything about this weekend makes you feel like this is the time to go and get it. Go and get it. In softball, number 7 LSU dropped its final midweek game of the regular season to the 19th-ranked Cajuns. Cajuns win it 9-4. LSU opened up the scoring and took a 2-0 lead in the first. And just like UL had a 2-0 lead in the first back just a few days ago when they played in Baton Rouge, well, it fell apart for the Cajuns then. It fell apart for LSU last night. So congratulations to the Cajuns for getting the win and showing that they are certainly worthy of one of the top spots in the softball world. Yeah, they're good. They're really, really good. Really, really good. So we've got that to talk about as well. We don't talk much about track and field, but the fifth edition of the national rankings for the 2024 outdoor season came out, and LSU's women remain number one in the country. LSU's men moved up one spot to number three. LSU currently has 22 marks that rank inside the top 10 of the national rankings this week. So, hey, could another national championship be on the horizon? It's certainly possible. Certainly possible. Yes, indeed. 76ers guard Tyrese Maxey won the Most Improved Player Award yesterday. And the NBA, I don't know why the NBA comes out and says these things publicly. Why it does no good. The NBA said that Maxey was fouled twice at the end of Monday's loss to the Knicks in the NBA's last two-minute report. It does no good. It's not going to change the score. It's not going to change the outcome. It just is what it is. And unfortunately, that's all she wrote in that one. All she wrote. Herm Edwards. Remember old Herm? The former Arizona State coach who recruited and coached Jaden Daniels for a year or two. Received a 5-year show cause penalty for NCAA recruiting violations, one of the longest show cause penalties for a head football coach in NCAA history. Wow. Wow. Crazy. Just a reminder to show you, Jaden Daniels has been in college so long that he actually threw a touchdown pass to Brandon Ayuk over Demondori Lenoir to beat Justin Herbert's Oregon Ducks pre-COVID. That's how long he's been around. Crazy, 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 crazy. So all these stories and much, much more. The mock drafts are out, and it certainly appears. This draft, we've talked about it before, is well suited for the Saints. It's deep in talent at positions where New Orleans needs help: offensive tackle, wide receiver, cornerback. Unfortunately, it's not a deep draft overall, and that works against the Saints, who are one of nine teams with just two picks in the top 100 selections. Seven of their nine picks are in the last three rounds in a draft that most analysts say only goes 120 prospects deep. That could be a problem. So you got to believe the Saints will be aggressively wheeling and dealing in rounds 2 through 7. There's no way they're going to maintain the status quo and keep five draft picks in the fifth round. Now you got to figure out who to deal with and what to do and all that kind of stuff. So we'll see who that first pick goes to. It just all depends upon who comes off the board. Assuming Joe Alt is off the board, the Notre Dame offensive lineman, before they select, then you got a bunch of other players. And, you know, apparently the word is out that offensive linemen are moving up the charts and teams will be interested in taking them. So who knows who's going to still be around when the Saints are at 14. If they remain at 14. But a tackle seems like an absolute no-brainer pick. And we'll go over all of this with Chris Rosevoglu coming up in this first hour. So we have Christian Clark live from Oklahoma City talking Pels Thunder Game 2. Chris Rosevoglu on the eve of the NFL draft, his thoughts on the Saints. In hour number two, Grant Hughes will go over all the NBA playoff scenarios with our NBA feature reporter. And then it's hump day. Mike Hugonen will join us. What does he think about the SEC after all these spring games have come and gone? We'll talk to Mike about that. So with that in mind, at 11 minutes after the hour, let me welcome in my producer, James Mesh. Good afternoon, James. I have absolutely no idea what today's poll question is. How are you, man?
I'm doing fine, Jordy. This one is Raging Cajun theme since we just got back from Russo Park. We had asked you on Facebook and on X, which Raging Cajun's Diamond team will host NCAA regionals? Both have been doing pretty well so far.
Sure,
the options
sure
that
have.
We gave were just softball, just baseball, both, or neither. 46% have said just softball, 39% have said both, 12% have said neither, and the last 2% are saying just baseball.
Oh, I don't know. You know, LSU is down, so if they're fortunate to get into a NCAA tournament, they will certainly not be hosting one. So that, I think, opens the door for the Cajuns baseball team. Softball, I think they'll have a tougher go at it, in my humble opinion. But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see. I just think one of them will get one at this point in time, but there's still some baseball left to go. What do you think?
I think there's a really good opportunity for both of them to do it. I mean, the fact that baseball, they have been on an absolute roll. I know that it wasn't the best weekend at Coastal, but still, that was against a good Chanticleer's team, and you got plenty of weekends to get back right on the on that
can
mark.
They,
and then softball's been on an absolute
their
roll.
RPI?
It might
with
be
the, with the schedule that they play. I don't know if that's possible.
It's going to be a little tough. I think if you made me pick between one or the other, I would pick just softball. If I had, but okay. I still think both have a good chance.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hey, that's all you can ask for at this point in time. They're in this in the discussion, and that's awesome. All right. Continue the vote on X and on Facebook. And we'll continue this process throughout the course. But the fact that both are in consideration for says an awful lot about both programs. That's terrific. All right, we'll take our first time out of this Wednesday, this hump day. We're heading to Oklahoma City. Christian Clark previews game two. What adjustments are the Pels going to make next?
You're listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station and your home for the LSU Tigers.
Back to the NBA playoffs we go tonight. It's game two between the New Orleans Pelicans and the Oklahoma City Thunder. It's an 8:30 tip in OKC. Christian Clark has been seeing all the sights and the sounds of Oklahoma City as he joins us today from NOLA.com in the OKC. Christian, huh? You had a couple of days. This series is crazy. I mean, you had a couple of days off and, you know, you play. Now you're on Wednesday. You play again on a Saturday in New Orleans. A lot of downtime. Is that good, bad, or indifferent, you think?
I mean, honestly, I would have loved if they had just played Tuesday after playing Sunday here, just had the one day in between, but
right.
You know, it is what it is. It was a crazy turnaround for me. I mean, I got home from that playing game on Friday. I mean, I guess Saturday at 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I got up at 5 o'clock to fly here and start this series. So the playing game makes the turnaround really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. It's always about adjustments and what are you? How are you going to offset what Oklahoma City did in game one? I mean, Pels had the game in their hands. It was right there for the taking. But, you know, down the stretch, just didn't happen.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that was a concern coming into the series, you know, just late game execution, especially, you know, the Pelicans being without Zion Williamson. The Thunder were number two in the NBA in crunch time offense. If you just look at, like, last 5 minutes, score within five, the Pelicans, I think, were 26th. The only playoff team below them was the Miami Heat. So it was definitely a concern. I mean, the sequence of the game, to me, was when they got four shots in a row, the Pelicans, yep. and they didn't convert on any of them with a chance to yep. go ahead in the final 2 minutes. I just think, you know, you have to find a way to score on one of those possessions. They didn't, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander comes down, gets an and one, and puts the Thunder ahead for good right after that.
Yeah, down the stretch, 3 of 11 from the field, 4 turnovers in the final 5 minutes. Playoff basketball, as people should know by now, it's a lot different. The what the officials allow, the physicality is so much greater than it is in the regular season. And the Pels are going to have to figure out a way to get some players free. They're going to have more ball movement, more player movement, it seems like to me, than just trying to back people down and post up at the elbows and trying to just shoot over. It's too difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like the guy I look at specifically with this conversation is Brandon Ingram. I mean, he's going to get Lou Dort on him in his jersey. It's going to be extremely physical coverage. Brandon has to find a way to generate some more efficient offense for himself, I think. You know, I asked Willie Green about that yesterday after practice. He says, I think Brandon just moving a little bit more, like without the ball, would help. And he said, setting screens is another thing. You know, if you want to get yourself open, set a screen for a teammate. I think if, you know, Dort is going to press up on Brandon like that, Brandon's got to try to just dribble around him and get to the rim and use your pump fakes too. Get them up in the air, get into them, get fouled, and find ways to go to the free throw line. But, I mean, they definitely need Brandon to shoot better than 4-15 in this game.
Yeah, no question. The best way, you just said it, become a screener. And screen, pop out, whatever you need to do, but screen, and that then you'll either force a switch, or you'll have that breathing room if the ball is shifted quickly to you, and then we can go from there. Gilgeous-Alexander is a problem. He is clutch down the stretch. Even as good as Herb Jones is as a defender, he's just got so much shaking and bacon and sidestepping to his game. I don't know how you defend him.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a top-tier isolation scorer in the NBA. I mean, a guy who is kind of ambidextrous with the ball, like can dribble and finish with either hand. You know, he's just a very graceful player who, you know, moves kind of at his own speed. And, you know, he's got these great mid-range pull-ups, can make the occasional three. I thought Herb did a really nice job on him in game one. It took Shea 24 shots to score 28 points. They did a fairly good job of keeping him off the line. You know, Shea is just so good that, you know, he's going to end up with his 25 or 30. It's really more of a matter of how much do you make him work for it.
It's almost, Christian Clark of NOLA.com, it's almost like you play three and a half quarters, and then it becomes a whole different game. And you've got to be able to have poise under pressure in late game situations. With that in mind, and I know so much depends upon the ebb and flow of the game and who's hot and who's not, but who do you value? Who are the five best players out there that you believe do have poise under pressurized situations?
Hey, you were just cutting out there for a second. Can you repeat it?
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, give me five players that you want on the court when it's that time of the game, when you have to have poise, you know that there's pressure coming, you got to be able to make plays, not have turnovers, make smart decisions. Who are those five Pelicans you want on the court?
Yeah, I mean, love Zion Williamson. Sorry to bring that up. Look, Brandon Ingram has got to be out there for this team and playing better. I mean, and TJ have to be out there. And I do think like just a lot of the crunch time offense conversation, you know, is about those two guys just doing a little bit better and being more efficient. I definitely want Trey Murphy out there as a floor spacer and a scorer next to those guys. I like having Herb Jones out there with Trey. I mean, I just always feel pretty comfortable with with Trey and Herb on the floor. And then, you know, when you look at that fifth spot, they went with Larry Nance Jr. last game. You know, Willie Green loves to close with him. I thought last game was a game where they could have maybe looked at Jonas Valanciunas because he was playing really well. And this is a series where he can beat the Thunder up inside. So I think, you know, those are two options, but they could also just go small too. Like if Najee Marshall is having a game, go with Najee Marshall. You know, Jose is interesting. I think this is a difficult series for Jose, who has been nails for the Pelicans all season. But I'm curious what you think about this. I mean, the Thunder just have so many big guards and wings. It's tough for him out there because they just try to switch Shea onto him.
I don't like that matchup. I do like an occasional pop up a zone, because SGA is so good at getting to his spot. Maybe you pop up a zone in here and force him out a little bit further and make him give up the ball and see if some of those other guys can consistently shoot it. The fewer shots that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander gets, the better I feel. Maybe a zone every now and then would alter him a little bit and change the ebb and flow a little bit. I think that's something that the Pels should look at and try to integrate into their game plan. Not a steady diet, but after a timeout, change things up, put the zone out and see what it does.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, they did love, you know, throwing the zone defense out there as a curveball in the regular season. And it seemed like they were pretty effective at it. So I would not be shocked. You know, it's interesting because the Thunder were the most accurate three-point shooting team in the NBA, but they don't, you know, they're not like a terribly high-volume three-point shooting team. Like, they don't take a ton of them, but when they do shoot them, they're very, very accurate. But, look, I think that's really interesting. I mean, the thing the Thunder want to do on the offensive end is just break you down off of the dribble. They're number one in the NBA in drives. They just got a lot of guys to put the ball on the floor and create problems for you that way. And, you know, to your point, a zone is definitely one way to, like, try to counteract that.
Yeah, just every now and then throw it out there and see. And if you get a good possession, which ends with a rebound, then you stick with it until they figure it out. You got to these players are too good. You cannot guard them man-to-man in its entirety. They're just too good. Although the game was a low-scoring game by NBA standards because I think both teams were like, wow, look what we're getting away with here. Let's just keep banging and bumping, and if they're not going to blow the whistle, we're just going to keep banging and bumping some more.
Yeah. I mean, look, the physicality just in general in the series is, I think, was really noteworthy in game one. I mean, when you've watched the Pelicans in the NBA overall since October, it's like a different sport than it was October, November, December.
Yes.
I mean, they're allowing so much more contact to go on. I mean, that was like one of the biggest notes coming out of game one was just the overall physicality. Larry Nance Jr. said it was like I was playing in a football game. And I think Larry Nance Jr. mostly likes playing that way. But, yeah, they were letting stuff go. I mean, the Pelicans shot 9 free throws. Pelicans did not shoot fewer than 10 free throws in a regular season game. So that was like a season low in free throws in playoff game number one.
Don't you think after the NBA came out with the ruling, which does no good for the Philadelphia 76ers, the fact that they said, yeah, Tyrese Maxey was grabbed and pulled, should have been 2 fouls called. That memo goes to all the officials. I would be surprised if they let the physicality go as much as it did in game ones. Now, I have a funny feeling that there may be a tighter whistle coming. So the teams that can adapt and adjust to that and not let it get into their heads certainly has an advantage as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, you know, like the people around the Pelicans, there's kind of a lot of belly aching about the officiating, but when you ask Willie Green about it, I mean, he's like, look, this is just what it is, and we just have to do better. Like, this is how it's going to be in the playoffs. And I like that messaging from Willie. I mean, you know, Willie's generally like a pretty no excuses guy. So I like that he said that. And it's probably a good thing for the Pelicans because Shai can like feast off of that stuff. I mean, he's not a foul grifter. He's not like prime James Harden or anything, but he is a guy who will embellish and use that to his advantage. And if you're the Pelicans, I mean, you obviously do not want that.
That's right. All right, Christian Clark. You had some downtime. I don't know if Oklahoma City is the greatest city to have some downtown, but I'm sure you got a lot of rest. And then game two tonight at 8:30, game three back in New Orleans on Saturday. So some more time off. It's crazy. It's crazy how they do these playoffs, but we'll see what happens. So we look forward to hearing, reading your reports on NOLA.com. And thank you for the time as always, buddy. Love talking with you.
Hey, man, thank you so much for having me.
You got it, buddy. Christian Clark with us here. Pels Thunder, 8:30 tonight in Oklahoma City. Big news on the Saints front. We'll talk to the man who announced it. Or does this clear things up for the draft even more so? Chris Roseverglue next.
Back to the sports talk you not only want, but need. This is ESPN, 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
You know, they say timing is everything, and the time is right as we've got Chris Roseverglue on us, our Saints and NFL insider, and kind of shocking news. Chris, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Jordy. I'm doing well. Hope you're doing well, too.
I'm doing great. I mean, Saints guard James Hurst announced today that he's calling it a career after 10 seasons. So not only do the Saints need a tackle, now they need a guard. I mean, this NFL draft is becoming crystal clear for the Saints now. How surprised were you by this, if at all?
I'm a little surprised. It's not like the biggest shock in the world just for one reason. When Hurst did that reworked contract, it wasn't like your typical restructure where you're still going to see the money. You're just moving it into a different fashion. It was literally just a pay cut, and it goes from him going $3.5 million to a little over $1 million. And when you make a move like that, I thought, you know what, maybe he's understanding he might be a backup next season, you know, a rotational piece. So you kind of take whatever you can instead of going on the open market. But look, this takes away depth, even if they didn't think he was going to start this year, where, if I'm going to be quite honest, I actually had him to start this year at left guard because I think the focus is going to be tackle. So to your point, I think this just makes this need even more dire than it already is. And it's not what I want to say because I don't want people to sound the alarms on April 24th, but the Saints have only two offensive linemen right now that they trust to start, and that's Eric McCoy and Cesar Ruiz. Because, you know, if you think Hurst, you know, retirement's going to be a big deal, I wouldn't be surprised in a couple months' time we find out that Ryan Ramczyk's also riding off into the sunset. So I think it's a lot of work to do, especially in the trenches.
Wow. I was going to ask you, and if you don't have, if he's not in the building, we can just call him player Z, player X, player Y, whatever. Let's go through that five-man front for the New Orleans Saints and who. And you can throw in a draft pick that you think the Saints are going to get at 14. And then I'm follow up with a question after that. But what give me your best guess here.
Yeah, my best guess at the moment, and I don't know how it'll play out because I think it depends if the Saints double down on offensive line in the draft. So let's just assume they take one. I think whoever you take at pick 14, that's going to be one of your starters at tackle. I believe the other starter, and this can change, I hope it's Trevor Penning. But for my money, I think I would probably say it's Landon Young at the moment. I think that's just someone that the Saints trust a little bit more than Trevor Penning. Now, maybe this new offensive line coaching staff comes in and really gets the best out of him. And if that's right, the case, that'd be great. But my guess right now would be pick 14 at left tackle, your right tackle, Landon Young. My guess is you feel pretty good about McCoy and Ruiz being the center and right guard. Left guard's the interesting spot. Do you try and grab a vet? They had, you know, vets kind of funnel in there. My other thought would be I'm calling Andrus Peed and seeing what he wants just to come back, because not only has he played left guard for the Saints multiple times, he can also kick out at tackle. That would help out. But if not, maybe look at Nick Saldiveri. I think that's someone who the Saints drafted out of Old Dominion last year because of his ability playing the interior. And I'd like to think that one of these offensive linemen that the Saints draft actually gives them something. So I'll say Nick Saldiveri at left guard, but I don't feel great about that. That's more of a shot in the dark at the moment.
This leads me to believe that the Saints to your point, are going to double down, and they're going to go with two offensive linemen with their draft picks. That just seems to be the smart thing to do. Is it?
I think it is. Look, the question would be, when do you do it? But look, if you're sitting there, you take your guy at 14. Let's say, you know, Fashanu or Fuaga's there, and the Saints are like, hey, we got who we wanted, but we feel great. I think once you're at 45, you got to start paying attention to the board, because there could be another offensive lineman that they like, and it doesn't even have to be a tackle. What if, you know, Powers Johnson from Oregon sitting there, or if for some reason Barden from Duke's falling, or Frazier from West Virginia. So I think maybe at 45, you start to be a little curious about, do I move up from that spot if there's a guy there that I like? But you're going to have to take another offensive lineman at some point. My question for the Saints, though, is when, because their draft setup right now is so interesting. You got pick 14, you got pick 45, and then you're not picking till way later on day three in like the pick 150. So that gap in between is the question mark. And the Saints can do it two ways. They can sit at 45 and take that guy, or if they want to be smart about this, maybe you move back and accumulate something. So
yes,
that's what I would do, but I definitely think they'll walk away with at least two offensive linemen in this draft class. Who knows, maybe even three.
How many players do you think grade out with a first-round draft grade? There's not 32 players with a first-round draft grade. What do the analysts think about this? I know there's some great players, but how many of them are there?
Yeah, I think when you look at this draft class, I would not be surprised if people have it in that 16 to 18 range. And it doesn't mean that there's not a lot of good players in this draft class. Although this historically, and a lot of people believe it's due to NIL, is going to be one of the weaker classes in terms of depth. They think next year's going to be the class where, you know, rounds one to five, you're going to get a good player at some point. I think, though, it's somewhere in the 16 range. I think people love the offensive tackles in this draft class, so this turns out to be a really good situation for the Saints to go get one. And I think people love the top heaviness of the receivers with Neighbors, with Marvin Harrison Jr. and Rome Odunze. But I think when you get into that kind of 20 range, it's just a guessing game. You know, I think you might see guys that like Xavier Leggett from South Carolina, who I think is a very good player, but he might sneak into the 20s. And, you know, if I were to take him in a different draft class, he might be in the 40s. So I would say somewhere in that 16 to 18 range of guys that probably have a round one grade on them.
Offensive line, offensive tackle, top priority. What's the next priority in a perfect world? Wide receiver? Cornerback? What is it?
I think it is wide receiver. I think it's getting another pass-catching weapon in there, and I don't know if that means wide receiver. I don't know if that means tight end, but just someone who makes an impact in the passing game. And, you know, right now, with the Saints needing offensive linemen, that probably takes them out of the Brock Bowers sweepstake, and he's such an intriguing prospect. But, you know, later in the draft, there's a guy from Kansas State and Ben Sinnott, who I think is a very, very intriguing prospect. I think he would give the Saints another element at tight end. So it could be someone like that. It could be wide receiver. You know, the Saints have done their homework on Keon Coleman from Florida State, Malachi Corley from Western Kentucky. So players like that kind of fit the mold of what Clint Kubiak likes with guys that are explosive after the catch. So I would probably look there, because I like that the Saints have young talent at wide receiver. I'm very confident in Olave. I like Shaheed's progress, and A.T. Perry played really well at the end of the year. But I think that for the Saints to be great at wide receiver next year, we're all going to have to bank on those three young guys to take that next step. And they very well all could. I think the talent's there. But instead of banking on that, why not add one more guy so you feel a little bit better about the group as a whole?
Why do I like Keon Coleman? I mean, he's the antithesis of what you've got already. He's taller. He's got some Michael Thomas in him. Just the look of him, the size and the strength. I'm not saying he is Michael Thomas, but man, if that's an intriguing prospect if he's still on the board for the Saints, I think.
And I think you're right. And when Michael Thomas got cut by the Saints, that was actually one of the first guys that people started mentioning as a potential replacement. So I think you're absolutely right with that, Jordy. And I think for him, if I rewind about, I don't want to say a year ago, but like several months ago, he was projected to go in the top 15. So if you get a guy like that at like 45, I think you walk away from those first two picks and say, I think I have guys that will make an impact week one. Cause that's what a lot of this is going to be about for the Saints. You know, we want them to get better in the future, and you want them to get guys that will be pillars for this team for years to come, but you also need guys to play right now, especially if they're going to compete in the NFC South. And I think Keon Coleman would do that. And to your point, you know, I think Olave and Shaheed, as good as they can be at times, they kind of feel like a little bit of a finesse style game to them. I think Coleman would give them a little bit of a mean streak that they could use at wide receiver.
Nice guy over the middle, throw it up, let him go get it. if you had to pick between the two and they were both available, would you get a top level safety or a cornerback? What does this team need more? Marcus May's gone. The Honey Badger's like, what, 10th, 12th season in the NFL? He's getting long in the tooth. Jordan Howden's been pretty good, but safety seems to be a position, or is it corner?
You know, I think safety's a bigger need. I think the Saints might feel better about taking a cornerback and figuring out a role for them, but I think safety is without a question a bigger need. To your point, you mentioned what they have right now. Like, yeah, I think Tyrann Mathieu can still play really high-level football, but he's also going to be a year older. We don't know what Jordan Howden's going to be, and maybe they're confident in Jordan Howden, and if so, yeah. I guess we'll find out this upcoming weekend. If they don't get a safety at all, maybe that kind of speaks about that. And look, you can go get a safety in free agency. I think that the Saints are the type of team that are really smart about the comp pick formula. So I would not be surprised if after Sunday, when these don't factor into it, they start going crazy and adding some veterans on cheap deals that, you know, are probably just expiring contracts, and that could work. But I would look at safety, because with corner, I expect them to have Lattimore for next season. But not outside of him, you know what you have in Adebo. I think he took a huge step. Yeah. Alante Taylor, did he have a down year? Yes.
Still waiting.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, you got another guy in Ugo Amadi who, you know, he's not a household name, but he's a guy who can play in the slot. So I think the Saints have four cornerbacks they like there. They got one safety they can trust. So with that math, that's where I'd probably go safety and add someone at some point in this draft.
With this lack of depth in the draft, when do the Saints determine, okay, you know, we got our offensive linemen. Now we just got to go after the best, the highest rated player we have on the board, no matter what position. When does that come into play, do you think?
You know, I think it works both ways. I think for the Saints, it could come into play as early as Thursday. If there's a run on tackles and they feel like they got to move up, not be surprised. So I think they're one of those teams that they – don't let other teams kind of dictate what they do. They want their guy. And I think for them, that could be a factor. But I think you're looking at day two. I think day one, hopefully, goes in a way where the Saints, no matter what they do at 14, they get a player that they trust, especially onto the offensive line. I think day two is where it's interesting, because the Saints are going to have to figure out that balance that we mentioned. Like, they need more picks, especially, you know, whether it's third or fourth round. But on the other hand, if you don't believe this is a deep draft, do you feel like, hey, maybe I start thinking about getting picks for next year. So I think that's something they have to factor. But I think day two is where we're going to hear and see Mickey Loomis, Jeff Ireland, all those guys work the phones, because that's where it's going to get interesting. Because I know there's talk about an offensive tackle run in this draft. But
it sure is.
I still feel like to some degree there's going to be four quarterbacks taken within the first 10, and that will hopefully push at least one of those guys that the Saints want to 14.
If Fuaga is gone and Fautanu is gone and Fashanu is gone and Alt is gone, let's say there's five of them, certainly possible before the Saints pick. Is J.C. Latham good enough at number 14 for the Saints to pick and to plug in and play right away and be good?
So in terms of, do the Saints like him and does he fit their kind of prototype? The answer is both yes to those. For me personally, though, out of the guys that you mentioned, I have him graded the lowest, and it doesn't mean that I don't think he could be a good player. I think there's a lot of talent there with him. I just have two concerns. One of them is Alabama offensive tackles lately have kind of struggled moving to the NFL, so that bothers me a little bit. But more importantly for the Saints, I don't think he is as polished as some of those others. Like, you know, I know they're not going to get Joe Alt, so I'm not worried about him. He's going to go top seven. He's such a good prospect, but you know, I look at a guy like Fuaga, and he doesn't make mistakes. Everything is so fluid. And I also value versatility with him, because we mentioned the O-line.
Yeah,
you can play him at guard, you can play him at tackle, wherever you want. But I think Latham would probably be the pick at 14 for them. I just think there's a little bit more work you have to do with him as opposed to the other guys. But I also think there's some work you have to do with Fashanu. I think he's a little raw to some degree. It's just he's so talented that it kind of overcomes those raw abilities that he has at times. But I think that Latham would probably be the pick. That would be my guess. But I also wouldn't rule out, and I don't see him falling at 14, another Alabama player in Dallas Turner, because I've heard the Saints really like him. I just don't think they expect him to be anywhere close to pick 14.
Boy, he's an impactful player from the get-go. You got to protect the quarterback, and you have to affect the quarterback. So, and that's what every team wants to do. So we'll see. A lot of wheeling and dealing going on. It's got to be a bunch of trades in this. Too many teams need And everybody's talking about the Vikings, but man, Las Vegas needs a quarterback bad. They've got to do something, don't they? And then who knows with Denver?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, Jordy, is I think the interesting thing about this draft is you have two teams literally picking one after the other in the same division with the same problem. They don't have a quarterback.
And that's right.
You know, there's going to be, when push comes to shove, who's going to be the guy that makes that big offer? And I think the team that I would look at, because there's so much talk about Arizona, but I think Arizona is one of those teams where you got two first-round picks. You could take Marvin Harrison Jr. Or Malik Nabers, whoever you want. I wouldn't overthink it. I'd probably just get that receiver at right. four. I think the draft really starts at five with the Chargers.
Chargers, I agree.
They got holes everywhere. And they've gotten rid of a lot of veterans because of salary cap issues. So if you want to build this the right way, if you go from 5 to 12 or 5 to 13, you still get a good player that you want, and you get a bunch of other picks that you can use, and maybe that pick is for next year. Maybe you're stockpiling for the future because you're going to give Jim Harbaugh this long runway to get things going. So I'm looking at Denver, and I'm looking at Vegas. There's a lot of rumors about Sean Payton like J.J. McCarthy, and if that's the case, he's going to have to make a big swing. So because of that, I think if you tell me there's five quarterbacks taken in the top 13, I would not be surprised. There's a lot of people that think Bo Nix could sneak in there. I don't know if I would take him in the top 13, but he could sneak in there. But yeah, Denver and Vegas, those are the two teams that I think are going to be super aggressive. And I wouldn't rule out, obviously, Minnesota because they have the two first round picks and the Giants. But I think that's only if Drake May slides.
I'll just say this. If I'm Justin Herbert, I'm going to Harbaugh and say, don't trade it. Get me Malik Nabers if he's still on the board. Get me Malik Nabers and let's go have some fun. That's my thoughts. Chris, we'll see what happens. We'll talk next week after we recap it. You can analyze this thing and tell me if the Saints did what we hope is great or if they were middle of the road. But thank you, my friend. Appreciate it.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me, Jordy.
All right. We'll take a timeout. We'll wrap up our number one next.
The biggest headlines in the world of sports are discussed here. ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
All right, wrapping up our number one, James Mesh. Let's do our poll question. Is it softball? Is it baseball? Who's going to host a regional? What do the voters out there say about the Cajuns?
46% that just softball will host a regional. Just baseball only has 2% of the votes. 39% think that both are going to be able to do it. But then there's also that 12% that are ultra negative and are saying that neither will be able to host.
Neither. Okay. Strength of schedule, you know, all that stuff factors in. They keep on stacking wins, winning their conference tournaments. That certainly will play a role in the assessment. So we shall see. We shall see. We'll see what's going on in hour number two. Grant Hughes will join us. Boy, the NBA playoffs have been so stinking good. We'll get his thoughts on all the matchups. And Mike Huguenin will join us as well as spring football's over. Transfer portal's open. We'll get Mike's assessment of how things is going to be the same old, Georgia, Ohio State. Is it going to be somebody else knocking down the door? What about LSU's chances? We'll see. It's all coming your way. Hour number two, right here on the Jordy Helfert Show, ESPN 103.7 Lafayette, ESPN 104.1 Lake Charles, streaming all over the world thanks to our mobile app. That's free, ESPNSouthwestLouisiana.com. We're the home, your home for the LSU Tigers and the Houston Astros.
This is ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
That's right. Can you dig it?
It's time for 2 hours of the best sports talk on the airwaves.
Can you dig it?
The Jordy Holtberg Show with your host, the Blonde Bomber himself.
Can you dig it?
Jordy Holtberg.
Hour number two of two, and away we go on this beautiful middle of the week, Wednesday, April 24th, the year 2024. Hope you're enjoying some things. Hour number one was a lot of fun. We talked with Christian Clark as the Pelicans get ready to take on the Oklahoma City Thunder in game two of their best of seven series. And let's talk about the NBA without further ado. And our NBA analyst from Bleacher Report out there on the West Coast, Mr. Grant Hughes, kind enough to join us as we begin our number two today. I don't know what you think, Grant, but I don't know if these playoffs can get much better than what we've seen of late. It's been tremendous so far.
Yeah, and you wouldn't think so, right, necessarily, because of the way that these games have gone. They've been lower scoring in large part. It kind of, a lot of people have said, oh, this feels like it's the 90s again. I'm here for it. I'm enjoying. It turns out we don't need 135 to 138 for the game to be entertaining. So everybody's playing harder. That always jumps out at you in the playoffs, where just suddenly you realize how different a game in December or February or whatever is to these games. So it's been a lot of fun so far. Definitely, just the intensity is the main thing that I've really enjoyed in the early going.
We've got several series with a 2-game-to-zip lead. Cleveland leads Orlando 2-0. Minnesota leads Phoenix 2-0. Denver leads the Lakers 2-0. And the Knicks lead the 76ers 2-0. Of those four, which team do you give the best chance to turn that thing around and maybe make it a series, if not maybe win a series?
Man, it's tough. I guess it's easier to rule out the ones I don't. You know, obviously, I think Denver is going to continue to steamroll. You didn't mention Boston. They'll be up 2-0, I assume, after tonight. Yeah. That one feels like it's been over since Jimmy Butler got hurt. You know, right. I initially did pick the Sixers to beat the Knicks, and that was on the assumption that if you can get a halfway healthy Joel Embiid, you know, the Sixers were just better than almost everyone but Boston when he was healthy during the year. That, you know, that would give Philly a chance, right? You've got the best player in a series. You've got a shot. I think I'd probably go there, even though watching Embiid trying to move around these first two games, it's against the Knicks,
terrible.
He's so clearly just can't move around. That he's been as productive as he has is a testament to how skillful he is. But, yeah, I don't feel great about any of the teams down 0-2 coming back. It's funny. You can just forget what your priors were going into these series. Cause you know, after game one, it just feels like there's no chance the team that's down could possibly come back and compete, but we know that's not how it goes. So some of these will be long series, but yeah, it does always feel like if you're down early, oh, it's just hopeless, even though we know that's not right.
It's obvious. You said the physical nature, the intensity increases when the playoffs, I mean, it's so evident and so obvious, but I wonder, after what happened in game two between the Knicks and the 76ers at the Garden and the last 2-minute deal by the officials where they go, okay, look, we made a mistake, and Tyrese Maxey was actually fouled twice at the end, and it certainly changed the game, although I blame Nick Nurse for losing that game.
Timeout.
Got a timeout.
Got to call a timeout.
Call the timeout and advance the ball. I don't understand that at all. But anyway, that message gets sent out. Why they do it publicly is beyond me. But does it change the way the officials call games now? Because they did blow it. They did let the aggressive nature take its course, and it changed the outcome of a game.
You know, I don't think so. I think what players always talk about is just wanting to know night to night, and you know, week to week would be great, but really just within a game, like how is this game going to be called? It's kind of like in baseball where it's like, I know this umpire strike zone is different in this way. You're going to get the outside pitch more often with this guy than you might with others. So I think players just want to know, is it going to be physical like this? Are we, I think Larry Nance said, you know, the second half was football of game one, and I'm good with that.
Right.
So as long as they know what the expectations are, what's a foul, what's not a foul, and it stays consistent, I don't think the league has a reason to change anything. So my hope is, and my expectation is, we will continue to see a ton of physicality. And I don't think the players are going to have a problem with that. You know, they'll hate missed calls. That's not going away. But I don't think it's necessarily true that because the officials are allowing more physicality, there are more missed calls. The stuff at the end of the Sixers game was, you know, obviously it's hard to get past, but I hope they won't, and I don't think they will change the level of physicality that's being allowed.
The other game you have to focus on is what happened late, whether it was, no matter what side of the fence you're on, But that play against Jason Tatum late by the Miami Heat, it'll be interesting to see how the officials handle that.
Yeah, I mean, any kind of, I guess I should be clearer, and I know you feel the same way too. We want physicality and we want the whistles kind of put in pockets, but we don't want dangerous stuff to happen. I think that's kind of the difference. So that sort of thing, I think maybe there'll be a tighter leash just because, you know, tempers can flare. And we saw really early, like in last night's game, for example, Devin Booker of the Suns and Jaden McDaniels of the Wolves, you know, just get into a shoving match, basically running down in transition. And that got nipped in the bud pretty quickly. So that is something to watch out for, though. If you're going to allow more physical play, the guys are going to get upset more often, and you do run the risk of like a potentially dangerous thing, or, you know, fight, or even though we don't see a lot of fights players anymore, but stuff like that.
Players
can
can't be that stupid. Players can't get in the fight because they won't play in the next game, so they'll take it to a certain level and then they'll break off. I mean, if they're smart.
Well, that's on the officials too. You know, you got to have a sense of the moment, and I think referees in the playoffs too can be, in a good way, a little more careful about giving out that second technical, for example, or about, you know, issuing a flagrant two, that kind of thing. Because there are repercussions. You know, if you get a suspension, it can change a series.
Well, the Timberwolves have surprised me, and the Suns, I don't understand. It's just not working. But Anthony Edwards and that group, boy, he's something, man. And I don't see Phoenix. I see no way Phoenix wins this thing. I think Minnesota's on the rise, man. I really do.
Yeah, I liked Phoenix coming in just because I didn't think Minnesota's offense was going to be able to do anything. And really, the offense hasn't been great. It certainly wasn't in game two. But that Wolves defense is just everybody they put out there can really guard. Rudy Gobert is going to win Defensive Player of the Year most likely. But, you know, Edwards can guard. McDaniels can guard. They bring guys off the bench like Alexander Walker that can guard. They're long. It's fun to have a team that – you know, we don't get a lot of these that are just really defined by defense. And if the league is going to start calling games like they are now, that really favors, you know, physical overpowering defenses. So that's a fun thing to me. I'm into that.
Sometimes throwback is good. It is. I noticed you mentioned that the Celtics would take a 2-0 lead over the Heat. The Pelicans had game one against the Thunder. They had four chances. They just couldn't get the ball to drop. They had it right there. Game two tonight. What do you think?
I mean, I can't get off of game one. I think the Pelicans know it. Like, that's one they should have gotten. They could have stolen it, right? Like, that's the opportunity as an 8 seed that if you have anything close like that, man, you got to get that one. And it was, you know, I think so going into game two, that's a tough, like, sort of mental thing to get past, knowing you probably should have had that one. But, you know, look, the Pelicans have advantages, right? They can just kill the Thunder on the boards. Valanciunas can do whatever he wants. He can put Chet Holmgren in the basket on post-ups. I don't think you can win offensively by, you know, Valanciunas goes for 40 points or whatever. Like, that doesn't seem realistic to me. No. But yeah, they can guard the Thunder. They can beat them up. They can be bigger, stronger, more physical. It's just, without Zion, you just don't have that guy that's going to bust through the defense and generate free throws, for example, and get, you know, point blank looks. So you're really dependent on Brandon Ingram making really tough shots. Like, it seems like every shot that guy takes is really hard and contested. You're going to have to get a really good offensive performance from one or two guys to kind of keep pace. So, but there are advantages. It's not like this is totally hopeless, you know, sweep, you know, deficit situation, but it's just going to be tough for New Orleans.
I know a little bit about this, but Ingram's going to have to become a screener before he becomes a scorer, because the screening is going to allow him to shake off of Dort and whoever else. He just needs an inch, and then that most difficult shot is not as difficult. And I think on the other end, you can't play Oklahoma City man-to-man the entirety of a game. I think what they do well is they put the ball on the deck and they get to the rim. You got to throw a zone in there every now and then. And I know they shoot the ball well from outside. They don't do it that often. You got to make them prove it that they can beat you from out there instead of letting Shai Gilgeous-Alexander just kind of probe and pick and get wherever he wants to. Throw a zone up.
Yeah, I mean, and look, the New Orleans roster has got the length among their wings, right? Herb is just can cover a ton of ground. Trey Murphy's got a lot of length. Ingram is long. Ingram, I've never thought Ingram has been as effective defensively as kind of his tools should allow him to be. But they got the bodies to do it. I think too, anytime Josh Giddey's on the floor for the Thunder, if the Pelicans aren't trying to hunt him and get him involved in some ball screen action and try to get him on an island, like that's the guy to go at. And like honestly, they may not be doing that because they want Giddey on the floor over Cason Wallace, the rookie who was guarding McCollum on that last potential game tying attempt, game winning attempt there. I think Giddey is someone you got to go at, and if that forces him off the floor, fine, but at least you made some hay a little while against really the only weak link in that Thunder lineup.
Not to talk about the officials anymore, but you know who kind of runs this league, and LeBron's chirping about the officials. I'm just really curious to see how this all unfolds. I really am.
Yeah, isn't it funny that he didn't have anything to say after the Lakers shot more free throws than Denver did in the first game? Yeah. It's funny how when you come out on the wrong end, you've got some different opinions. If anyone's going to sway how things are officiated other than Adam Silver, then it's probably him. But, I mean, it's just, I know the Nuggets needed a game winner to take game two, but I don't know if there's not a team that feels just more inevitable than Denver to me. Like, I don't care if they're down 10 at the half or whatever. Mm-hmm. It feels like you just can't hold them. You can't hold them back forever. They're just going to find ways to beat you. And, they won the title last year. This isn't some revelation, but like those guys, they just got it figured out in ways that you just don't see in the rest of the league. It's even different from Boston, just because these Celtics, these Nuggets guys have been together forever. It feels like, and Jokic just makes everything possible on offense.
Good. Yeah, just so good. We talked about turning back the clock and how good that was. Defense, getting after it, physicality, really great basketball. It was so enjoyable watching Madison Square Garden erupt like it did. I mean, it just brought back long time ago memories. But man, that when that place is kicking it, it's some kind of special place, man. It really is.
It feels right, doesn't it? It really, yeah. I caught myself watching that game, and I was definitely, prisoner of the moment, but just thinking, like, this is a perfect kind of Knicks team to just become kind of a legendary, iconic group. Not saying they're a title threat necessarily, but just you got Josh Hart playing 48 minutes, and he played like 40 plus, it seemed like, the whole second half of the season, and Tom Thibodeau is just driving these guys into the ground, and that, Jalen Brunson has no business being an all-NBA player, but he is somehow. They just play so hard. And I'm 100% with you. The Knicks are – it feels right to me that the Knicks are this grimy, competitive, inspiring group, because it's been – it's been 30 years since we had a team really like this for the Knicks.
And, they just don't have what – they don't have those marquees. They just don't.
No.
They play hard. They play together. When this NBA season's all said and done, who's going to be a bigger disappointment, the Suns, the Phoenix Suns, or the LA Clippers? Because I don't think the Clippers can beat Dallas now. I just don't.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Most people would say the Suns. I guess I'll say the Suns just because they don't have any outs now. They traded away. They don't have a first-round draft pick until 2031 that they control, because it cost them so much to get Kevin Durant and then get Bradley Beal. And I don't know. I'm not saying I'm rooting for the Suns to fail. We want everyone to do well and on and on. But, like, I don't like putting a team together the way that the Suns did. It felt short-sighted. Mm-hmm. It felt risky. It felt like trying to just make a fantasy team. And it doesn't bother me when that team-building model fails. I like the continuity. I like the draft. I like building a team with role guys that make sense. And the Suns just kind of threw three stars together and said, we'll figure out the rest later. And they're not going to figure it out.
I think if they could go back in time, they'd keep Chris Paul and their center and forget about trading and just run it back one more time and see if it could work. Don't you?
They were in the finals, right? They were in the finals. We thought they were going to beat the Bucks in, what was it, 21? And then they win 60-something games the year after that. And then you get new ownership, and he blows the team up to get Kevin Durant. Yeah, I mean, look, where they're headed now is it's a dark road, because you
usually if you're going to go into the tank, you know, and you got to give up on this core, you've got the draft to bail you out. They don't have draft picks. So it's just like, what's the next 10 years look like for this team? It's a little scary.
Who's going to have the better legacy when they sit in a rocking chair? What if Denver wins another title and Joker wins another MVP? And then you got Durant on the other side. Isn't Joker going to have a better legacy than Kevin Durant? Or is he not?
I think well, it's funny with Jokic that there are still some people, really former players for the most part, that just won't acknowledge how great he is because he doesn't do it the same way that like Jordan did it, that Kobe did it, and even Durant, really, right? Like, I think players a lot of times tend to overrate guys that could embarrass them as one-on-one scorers. Not to say Jordan and Kobe and Durant aren't great, but I think Jokic already, I think, has had a better career than Kevin Durant. And I think if he gets another title and another MVP, which he's definitely getting this MVP, I'd be shocked if he didn't. Then we're like, you know, the only guys we have to compare him to after that are, you know, just first ballot, short list, Hall of Fame, like top 10 type of players. Because his resume already is ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, it's hard to get you this time of the year, so I gotta get some predictions from you. Cavaliers Magic. Cavaliers win it?
Yeah, it's another Orlando just can't score. So I think the Cavs All have right. got that one pretty easily.
Minnesota, Phoenix. Minnesota?
Yeah, I think Minnesota gets game three, and then game four, we see Phoenix quit potentially.
Okay. Knicks 76ers. Who you got?
Yeah, I got to go against my initial pick of the Sixers. I'll take the Knicks there, you know, up 2-0, or why wouldn't you? But I just don't have any confidence that Embiid can be what he was earlier this year.
He can't. He's playing a guard position. He's not around the basket because he can't jump. Right. He can't get any lift. It's crazy. Nuggets over the Lakers. Let's go there. Celtics over the Heat. Mavericks, Clippers. Who you got?
I think it's got to be Dallas now. They split in LA, which I think was big. And now that Luke is playing defense, that was about the best defense I've seen him play in his career in game two. So if he can hold that, he doesn't have to do that every night. Get a couple more of those though, and I think the Mavs have it.
The Pacers, even their series with Milwaukee. Who do you like in that one?
Yeah, you know, I took the Pacers coming in just because I figured Giannis wasn't going to make it back. But then the Bucks getting game one might extend that series. So now maybe you do get Giannis towards the end of it. I still feel like the Pacers just match up really well. And if Giannis comes back, maybe he looks like Embiid, where he's just not even close to the same guy.
Yeah. Gosh, if Milwaukee loses this thing, do they have the built-in excuse with Giannis not there? Does that save Doc Rivers? Is he back to coach again?
I swear, I think that if they had it to do over again, they wouldn't have fired Mike Budenholzer. Because they're now two coaches down the line, and I don't think either of them are any better. But you can't fire this one now. Like, you can't pay four coaches at once, I don't think.
All right, what I think is going to be a really good series, and it may go long. Pelicans, Thunder, who do you like?
Yeah, I got to give it to the Thunder, only because Zion is, you know, it's not like rocket science, right? Zion is just such a critical player for New Orleans. And if you don't have him against the number one seed, that's just too big of a disadvantage for me.
You're the best. These playoffs have been great. I thank you so much for your time. Keep up the great work. We always love it. We're going to try and sneak you in again if we can get you. So I'm going to keep asking, all right?
Let's do it. Let's do it.
You got it. Grant Hughes, Bleacher Report, NBA Talk. Thank you, sir. We'll take a timeout. We'll come back with more here after this timeout.
Helping you get through your workday. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
All right, still to come, Mike Huguenin will be joining us here in just a minute. The fellas before me were over at the Teague doing a show today. James, you got your ears on?
Of course I do.
Okay, okay. I didn't get a chance to listen. Anything Coach Dez had to say about this football team? Don't they have their spring game that's indoors and closed to the public? So it's just kind of they'll do their own thing this weekend, right? Anything eventful that he had to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of more of the same. He didn't want to, like, put too much pressure on certain guys because he didn't want to get them injured. And, of course, since they're doing a little bit later than others, you know, that you always are going to have to worry about the transfer portal nowadays. So it's kind of like a balance between all of that. But he's kind of doing more of the same of what he was doing before.
Okay. So you've got that, and you got the voodoo have moved over from Lake Charles playing in Lafayette in playing on Saturday as well. What's the over under on how long that lasts? Two games, three games, maybe?
I think you could, because 7 of the 10 games are going to be at home, and we would presume it would be Blackman Coliseum. I think you could say over. I think you'll see a few games, but I don't know if you'll be able to see how far we go into it. It's kind of too early to tell. I am curious because I will be at the first game on Saturday.
Okay. Do they have any Cajuns playing on that team? If I was the coach or whoever owns that thing, that's what I would have done. Get some local flavor on there so people have a reason to want to come see it.
Yeah, there's actually quite a few local guys that had played high school ball around in the Acadiana area. There's quite a few that I can't name off top, but I remember we had talked with the head coach, Kevin did, the other day, and I mean, he had brought up quite a few guys that their whole plan was they get either guys that are from the local Acadiana area, or they just try to get guys that are just kind of the best that they could find from like signing guys. So it's going to be pretty interesting. Okay. So it's not a bunch of guys that are from only Pennsylvania and only from Minnesota. Yeah, like they got Louisiana guys that you can relate to and be like, oh yeah, I remember him. I remember he played at Turlings.
Let's do over under on attendance for the first game. I'm going to say if they get 300 people, that would be a success.
Yeah, it's going to be really tough because not only do you have to worry about Festival International that's going to be going on this weekend, but you also have the NFL draft. You also have college baseball and softball, and you also have to worry about
New Orleans for Jazz Fest too.
Exactly. So I mean, there's a lot going on this weekend. It's going to be tough to get a good crowd going, especially for the first game.
James Mesh will be in that number. I can't wait for a report on Monday. I want a full report from you. So take notes, jot it down. How would you like to be? Look, it's early. How many baseball games are there? 162?
In MLB, yes.
It may, MLB, 162 games. How'd you like to be the White Sox right now? they lost last night to the Twins 6-5. They are now 3-20. How bad is that? Well, the 1988 Orioles were 1-22. They're the only team in Major League Baseball history to have a worse start through 23 games. Only three other teams, the 2022 Reds, the 2003 Tigers, and the 1936 Browns, have gone 3-20. The Sox are hitting 192. They've been shut out 8 times already, and their road to relevance is long because their farm system ranks near the bottom of baseball. And thanks to new collective bargaining agreement rules, the highest they can draft in 2025 is 10th overall. How in the world, if you are making a living calling people up trying to sell tickets to that, how the heck do you eat, put food on your table? The Southsiders are awful, and nobody's going to watch them. The season's over. It's over, and we haven't even hit summer yet. Oh, well. There you go. We'll take a quick time out here. When we come back, Mike Huguenin will share some insight with us after these messages.
Go sign up for our rewards club at ESPNSouthwestLouisiana.com so you can score tickets, gift certificates, and much more. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
Hi, we are back. It's Hump Day Wednesday. That means it's time for Huguenin. Mike Huguenin, our college football, college basketball analyst, joins us each and every Wednesday that we can, and we're thrilled to have him. We've been doing this for years and years and years. Mike, good afternoon. What are your thoughts about Reggie Bush getting his Heisman back?
Yeah, the whole idea that you can't take somebody's Heisman away. I mean, I know you can take it away materially, but everybody knows, if you follow college football, you know that Reggie Bush was a Heisman winner. So it's sort of like, you know, the idea of vacating victories. The game was played, this team won. Reggie Bush played that season, he won the Heisman. So it's good to see the Heisman Trust regain a little bit of common sense.
Or he, when he was doing it at the Coliseum, I mean, that was must-see TV. He was electric.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, he and Lindale White were a phenomenal backfield for Pete Carroll. Yeah, one of the best college football games I've seen in the last 25 years came with Bush at USC when they beat Fresno State in a late Saturday night game back, I think it was in 2005. I think the final score was something like 56-48. Wow. Both teams were unstoppable on offense, but I think Bush had close to 350 total yards that game. He was incredible, and he was like you said, he was electric with the ball in his hands. He had a solid NFL career. I think if he played today for someone like the Chiefs, oh my God, he would put up numbers like he put up in college.
Yeah, well, he was. The Saints were very fortunate.
Yes,
that he
was.
Fell.
Like he was a solid NFL player. I just think that he could have. Yeah, I think his pro career wasn't quite as good as his college career, but by no means was he a bad pro. He was just a great football player. You know, not overly big, but compact, well put together, and could change directions on a penny, much less a dime.
He was something. He Reggie Bush, old number five. Everybody thinks Georgia is the cream of the crop. Carson Beck is back at quarterback, and Kirby Smart recruits, and he just keeps building and building. They're the favorite to win the SEC. Who do you think is the second best team after you saw Springs and got the reports from whatever you can take out of Spring, and all the additions and subtractions? Who do you feel is the second best team in the SEC?
I still think it's. I think it's Alabama. I think having a returning starting quarterback is gigantic. Milroe lacked consistency early on. A polished quarterback last year. I think he'll be fine. I think Kalen DeBoer's a really good coach. Do I think Alabama's going unbeaten? No. I think LSU's going to be strong. I'm intrigued by Texas A&M. I think they will improve with the new coaching staff. But I'll be honest, there's also a heck of a lot of, Texas is, Texas is probably the second best team. I don't know. I'm interested in seeing Oklahoma with Jackson Arnold. I think you can make a case that the four best teams, unquestionably on paper going into the season, Georgia, Texas, Alabama, and Oklahoma. Texas A&M's interesting. Tennessee's interesting. Missouri, I don't think, is going to replicate its success from last year. I'm not a believer in Ole Miss's defense. I know they spent a lot of money in the portal to get some interesting defensive players, but I'll believe it when I see it. But I think Texas and Oklahoma are going to make impacts right away, but I think Alabama and Georgia and LSU are going to be fine as well. And they're not worried about Texas and Oklahoma coming in. I think everybody else in the league is worried about them coming in.
Texas must have the best quarterback room in the conference when you think about who Arch the starter
Manning
is and if the starter gets hurt,
game.
Who
but,
the
you
backup
know, spring
is.
Games, you and I have talked enough over the last two decades. It's you take some of that stuff with a grain of salt. Was he going against the first-team defense? I don't think he was. And, you know, everybody, if you follow college football and go to a team spring game, you see somebody in the spring that you say, wow, this guy's going to be good this fall, and then he never sees the field. I'm not
That's
saying that
true.
About Arch Manning, of course, but it's just a roundabout way of saying, you know, spring game stats are one thing. Let's wait till the real games start again.
Yeah, I'm with you. Mike Huguenin joining us. Even though the playoff is going to be expanded, is it going to be the same crowd up there? I mean, Georgia, Ohio State. Who else do you project to be maybe some fresh blood in this thing, in this mix of college football?
I can see Oregon. getting in. Getting Dylan Gabriel to replace Bo Nix is a big deal. Oregon's got a robust NIL program. They had a good roster to begin with. I think they're trying to become more defense-oriented, which is smart going into the Big Ten, but I also think they're vastly ahead of most other Big Ten teams when it comes to offense. And that's the thing. You look at Washington coming in, even with a new coach. You look at USC coming in. You look at Oregon coming in, maybe even UCLA. Those teams are used to playing more, what's the word I want? More modern offenses. That's a simplistic way of looking at it. But, you know, if you watch a Big Ten game the last couple of years outside of Ohio State and Purdue when Braum was there, these were not cutting-edge offenses. I think Washington and Oregon and USC are bringing cutting-edge offense to the Big Ten to join with Ohio State. I think Michigan's taking a step back. Ton of talent gone. I wonder about the new staff. You can't believe in Penn State until you actually see them do something. And their offense last year bogged down anytime they played a good team. I think Oregon's going to be in the playoff. I can see four SEC teams in the playoff. The Big 12 is intriguing because you and I talked about this. Who's the bell cow now in that league? I don't know who it is.
I don't know.
So obviously they're going to have a team in. Clemson and Florida State look interesting in a couple of levels. Miami, I'm not a believer in Mario Cristobal, even though they spent a lot of money in the portal. But you know, I think Georgia's going to be in. I think Texas is going to be in. I think Alabama's going to be in. I think Ohio State's going to be in. I think Oregon's going to be in. I think there's going to be FSU and Clemson. No idea on the other ones, though.
Now, who's the best group of five team, you think?
That's a phenomenal question. I have zero idea on that.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be some more transfer portal movement from a couple group of five teams, both key players leaving and a couple of guys, you know, quote unquote, dropping down that could help a couple teams. But, you know, last year at this time, you're like, okay, Tulane's going to be really good. I don't think anybody expected Liberty to be this good.
No.
But, you know, Tulane, the quarterback's gone, the coach is gone. The AAC, I have zero idea who's going to win that. Maybe it's Memphis. I don't know. There's a lot of really cool storylines all over college football, and that's going to be one of them all season because the group of five, there's going to be one team in there. Which one's it going to be?
Yeah, that's right. If you had told people last year at this time that Jaden Daniels would win the Heisman and be possibly the number two pick in this year's draft, people would have gone, are you crazy?
So, right.
I guess the point I'm saying is he looked good in
2022 in his first year under Brian Kelly. But, you know, Heisman, come on. But,
what about Colorado's Shedeur Sanders? Is he going to be next year's Jaden Daniels?
No, I don't think Colorado is – if they're a – they might be a 500 team. I know that they've hit the portal hard for offensive linemen. And I know a lot of guys have transferred out, and I know Deion doesn't think that's a big deal. But part of the issue for Colorado last year was the drop-off between the starters and the backups was immense. Yeah. And you look at the offensive and defensive lines at Colorado, and you're like, okay, you had four offensive line starters transfer out. Okay, they weren't good starters, but they were better than their backups, or else they wouldn't have been playing. And now all those guys are gone, too. So, I think Shedeur Sanders will be running for his life. Not quite as much as last year, but some. I also think they took a gigantic step back offensively with the play call change. I think that was a bad mistake by Sanders, by Deion Sanders.
Yeah, he's not talking that much anymore like he did last year. But anyway, we'll see. What's your opinion on the NCAA board that approved immediate eligibility for multi-time transfers and that school assistance for NIL opportunities are out there? I know we briefly touched upon it, but again, I still say this is going to be, you know, where college football does their own thing down the road. It really is.
Yeah, there's going to be 30 to 40 teams that schools that pull out of football. You can transfer all you want as long as you're academically eligible. I think most players remain academically eligible. The NIL thing is, again, it's the haves and the have-nots, and the haves are going to have money to spend and be able to tie in their athletes with people who have money to spend. The bigger school you are, the more you have boosters who are willing to pony up for NIL. And I guess one sort of overlooked aspect of the transfer rule was that even grad transfers now, you have to be in the portal by the time the spring window closes. And that's a big change. In the past, you could wait until you graduated in May or June and then enter the portal. No more. You have to be in by, I think it's April 30th or June 1st, if you want to be eligible the next year. You have to be in the portal. So that's interesting. But, yeah, the idea that there are going to be players who play at four schools in 4 years, that's a given. I think there's going to be a ton of players who play at three schools in 4 years or 5 years. So I know there's a faction of fans who still have a hard time grasping that. You better learn to grasp it, and you better learn to grasp it quickly, because it's college free agency. That's what it is.
Yeah. Do you believe that the new rules changes, like the coach to player communication through the helmet to one player on the field? And how about the 2 minute timeout for each half now in college football? Is that going to make, and the 18 active tablets for use with the players and the coaches on the sidelines and all, is that going to change anything, make the game go quicker, be
no.
better? What do you think?
I think the two-minute warning, every college football fan, when they read that, should have vomited. Because just what college football needs, another TV timeout, and that's all it's going to be. I've read a lot of stuff about the helmet-to-helmet communication. If you watch a lot of college football, you know I've seen people say, "Well, that means all the placards are going away." No, it doesn't, because the way it works now, if you're an offensive lineman, you look at one spot. If you're a wide receiver, you look at another spot. So you can if you don't huddle, you can call the play into your quarterback, but your receivers and your linemen and your running backs, You're not going to huddle up all of a sudden. So I think that defensively that might be a bigger switch than offensively. But at the same time, you got defensive players doing the exact same thing, looking to a certain section of the sideline and finding out what your responsibilities are on this play. So I'm exceedingly interested to see how all that works. The placards are there for a reason. Again, offensive linemen aren't looking at the same placards as a wide receiver. So that's going to be interesting. But again, I think the overriding thing to me is the two-minute warning. What's wrong with being different from the NFL? And again, if you're a fan sitting at home and watching on TV, or even if you're in the stands, oh, great, another TV timeout at the two-minute warning. Great.
Yeah, I think we're going back to uniforms the old way, especially the pants. You know, that now they're wearing them up to their calves and their thighs, rather. I think they're going to move them down below the knees again with the knee pads and all that kind of stuff, because if not, you're going to have a flag and you're going to have to come off the play field for at least one play and return when that's corrected. I mean, I don't know why these things keep changing. Can we just keep it uniform?
Uniformed
across the board. I mean,
I don't understand the allure of wearing your pants above your knee anyway. But heck, you look at photos from late 90s in college basketball. You got shorts almost to the player's knees, man, below the player's knees on a basketball court.
That's
so
gone too.
Swung back the other way. The uniformity of uniforms is something that seemingly would be pretty easy to have. And you're right, they got to be below your knee, and you need to wear a knee pad. Well, that's for your safety, and you would think most players would realize that.
I'm with you. Mike Hugonen, he's the best in the business in O-Town. Thank you, my friend. The Magic are going to get swept, by the way.
Yeah, it's too bad, but other, at least they made it.
Yeah, but other than that, they're a team of the future because they're young and they're good.
They need some more offense, though. They got to draft a player who can put the ball in the basket.
There you go. Mike, thank you, buddy. Have a
great
weekend.
Talk to you next week. Thanks, man.
You got it, buddy. Mike Hugenin with us. We'll take a timeout. We'll close things out. Final poll results and a little on this day in sports history next.
You're listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, your home for the best local sports talk in Southwest Louisiana.
All right, we are back to wrap things up. Special thanks to our guest today. It was fun. Christian Clark on the Pels and the Thunder tonight in Oklahoma City. Chris Rosevoglou, one last James Hurst retiring. So how does that affect the Saints draft? We talked about that. Grant Hughes, the NBA playoffs have been terrific, and Mike Hugenin as well. James Mesh, let's go over our final poll results. Is it going to be the softball team hosting? Is it going to be the Cajuns baseball team hosting? Is it going to be both? Is it going to be neither? What do the masses say?
It was close, but 46% said that only softball is going to be able to host a regional. 39% did say both. 12% had said neither. And then there's that last 2% that thinks that it's just going to be baseball who's going to be able to host.
We shall see. There's still a lot of games left to go. A lot of it will depend upon how they do in their conference tournaments. Stacking wins, that's the key. When your RPI is not that high, you got to stack wins. And certainly softball helped their chances by beating a high-ranked LSU team yesterday at Yvette Girard Field at Lampson Park. So congratulations to them. All right, it was on this day 20 years ago, April 24th, 2004, the San Diego Chargers selected Eli Manning with the first pick in the 2004 NFL draft, then traded him to the Giants for Philip Rivers after Manning threatened to sit out the season. Now, behind the scenes, Eli said, "It was my decision." He said in 2021, shedding light on what went down, "I was just worried about the Chargers organization at the time. I quietly tried to say, hey, please don't draft me. It can be our secret." And they didn't keep the secret part very well. So there you go. And then also on this day in 1974, Tampa Bay was awarded an NFL franchise for what was then a record $16 million. 2 years later, the Buccaneers debuted. It was not the start they wanted. The Buccaneers infamously lost their first 26 games. 0 for 26. And of those 26, they were shut out in 11 of them. Wow. But they persevered and, you know, they won themselves a Super Bowl with Tom Brady. And now they're giving the Saints some problems here and there. But it was on this day in 1974. So there you go. Tampa by the Bay. All right. We are going to be off tomorrow because of the Houston Astros game. So we'll be back on Friday. And at that time, we'll recap the Saints draft after Thursday. We will preview the big baseball games. We'll talk about the Pels, see if they can get a win tonight, and so much more. James Mesh, thank you for all you do. Thanks to all of you for listening. Partners, love you. Couldn't do it without you. Until next time, I'm Jordy Hultberg. Stay thirsty, my friends. Do everything you can to stay healthy. Let's be kind to one another. By all means, be happy. AFR, live from the tap room at River Ranch, next. So long, everybody.